So welcome. We're partly through this chapter, Vijnana or Gnosis. Sri Aurobindo, in this first several pages, was distinguishing between intuition proper and intuition as it may play in the mind, and what is a rapid process of intellection that can deliver an answer quickly, but has nothing of the vertical nature of intuition. We come to know the distinctions the more we grow. As we are capable of stationing ourselves in a silent consciousness, we can see what is the source of the illumination that appears before us, pratyaksha, and we'll come to that term soon enough. Before the eyes, in a direct experience, we know by identity what is the truth, because it becomes us, it emerges from us, it moves from the one whose being is self-based, Swayambhu. So we open with a sentence that Sri Aurobindo did rewrite when he took this up in 1932. But even the intuitive reason is not the gnosis. It is only an edge of light of the supermind, finding its way by flashes of illumination into the mentality like lightnings in dim and cloudy places. This edge of light, which figures frequently in the life divine and makes an occasional appearance in Savitri, is something that best typified to Sri Aurobindo's mind what is the kind of illumination that intuition offers. He continues, its inspirations, revelations, intuitions, self-luminous discernings are messages from a higher knowledge plane that make their way opportunely into our lower level of consciousness. The very character of the intuitive mind sets a gulf of great difference between its action and the action of the self-contained gnosis. In the first place, it acts by separate and limited illuminations, and its truth is restricted to the often narrow reach or the one brief spot of knowledge lit up by that one lightning flash with which its intervention begins and terminates. So later we'll see this is why intuition must be raised up and supported by the larger light of the overmind for it to find its basis and to be able to act more broadly. We see the action of the instinct in animals, an automatic intuition in that vital or sense mind, which is the highest and surest instrument that the animal has to rely on, since it does not possess the human light of the reason, only a cruder and yet ill-formed intelligence. If you want to look at much of this, is taken up in The Life Divine in Chapter 8, The Methods of Vedantic Knowledge. And we can observe at once that the marvelous truth of this instinct, which seems so much surer than the reason, is limited in the bird, beast, or insect to some particular and restricted utility it is admitted to serve. When the vital mind of the animal tries to act beyond that restricted limit, it blunders in a much blinder way than the reason of man and has to learn with difficulty by a succession of sense experiences. The higher mental intuition of the human being is an inner visional, not a sense intuition, for it illumines the intelligence and not the sense mind. It is self-conscious and luminous, not a half-conscious, blind light. It is freely self-acting, not mechanically automatic. So this is the spontaneous vision of the spirit. The Rig Veda, in the first mandala, the 24th hymn, in the 12th verse, describes this beautifully. An intuition in the heart that sees the truth. You might also note from the Life Divine in the chapter Supermind, Mind, and the Overmind, Maya, which is right before book one closes, he says, intuition is in its very nature a projection of the characteristic action of these higher grades of the mind of ignorance. And a few pages later, in the same chapter, calls them flashes of lightning. But still, even when it is not marred by the imitated pseudo-intuition, it is restricted in man, like the instinct in the animal, restricted to a particular purpose of will or knowledge, as is the instinct to a particular life utility or nature purpose. So in other words, as the human develops in consciousness, evolves, then the capacity of intuition arrives within the mental range in a way that's suited to the nature of its next step. How to see more, how to consolidate, how to prepare for a greater future. And when the intelligence, as is its almost invariable habit, tries to make use of it, to apply it, to add to it, it builds round the intuitive nucleus in its own characteristic fashion, a mass of mixed truth and error. More often than not, by foisting an element of sense error and conceptual error into the very substance of the intuition, or by coating it up in mental additions and deviations, it not merely deflects, but deforms its truth and converts it into a falsehood. At the best, therefore, the intuition gives us only a limited, though an intense, light. At the worst, through our misuse of it or false imitations of it, it may lead us into perplexities and confusions, which the less ambitious intellectual reason avoids by remaining satisfied with its own safe and plodding method, safe for the inferior purposes of the reason, though never a satisfying guide to the inner truth of things. And so as he continues, you see that he's setting us up to step beyond intuition. So even if it's capable of giving us bright illumination on a point, it is not giving us the larger truth, the comprehensive vision. That is not its forte. And my forte is that I say forte. It is possible to cultivate and extend the use of the intuitive mind in proportion as we rely less predominantly upon the reasoning intelligence. We may train our mentality not to seize, as it does now, upon every separate flash of intuitive illumination for its own inferior purposes, not to precipitate our thought at once into a crystallizing intellectual action around it. We can train it to think in a stream of successive and connected intuitions, to pour light upon light in a brilliant and triumphant series. So this is part of our yogic action, is to invite the play of intuition, to be able to receive it purely without distortion, and then to multiply it. To invite not one ray, one bolt of lightning, but to make lightning rain in successive flashes, so that we see a more comprehensive field, that we're capable of receiving not a glimmer, not a revelation, but a powerful statement about the whole of the field, the scene before us, and then to sustain it so that the illumination does not fade. This bridges between intuition and overmind. We shall succeed in this difficult change in proportion as we purify the interfering intelligence. If we can reduce in it the element of material thought enslaved to the external appearances of things, the element of vital thought enslaved to the wishes, desires, impulses of the lower nature, the element of intellectual thought enslaved to our preferred, already settled, or congenial ideas, conceptions, opinions, fixed operations of intelligence, if, having reduced to a minimum those elements, we can replace them by an intuitive vision and sense of things, an intuitive insight into appearances, an intuitive will, and intuitive ideation. This is hard enough for our consciousness, naturally bound by the triple tie of mentality, vitality, corporeality to its own imperfection and ignorance, the upper, middle, and lower cord, and the Vedic parital of the upper, middle, and lower cord in the Vedic parable of the soul's bondage, cords of the mixed truth and falsehood of appearances by which Shunashepa was bound to the post of sacrifice. This is interesting because Shunashepa appears in the same hymn of the Rig Veda that we referred to a couple of moments ago. This again is Rig Veda, Mandala 1, the 24th hymn and the 12th verse. It's rather a couplet and describes that Shunashepa is symbolically bound and then is released from the truth within, because remember, he sees an intuition in the heart that reveals the truth. In the rest of that verse, and in following verses, it is Varuna who comes forth and releases the being. So it is the oceanic consciousness of the greatest of the early Vedic gods, he who represents the overmind, who provides the intuition articulating from the inner core of the human spirit to come forth and be delivered from this triple bondage to the body, to the emotions, to the appetites, to even our best thoughts, our friendliest conceptions. All have to be released if we want to live in the divine consciousness. So to quit being small and become large we have to offer. But the things that we offer are these very limitations. So, but even if this difficult thing were perfectly accomplished, still the intuition would not be the gnosis. It would only be its thin prolongation into mind, or its sharp edge of first entrance. Now, this is interesting because Sri Aurobindo rewrote this sentence, and originally, instead of saying it would only be its thin prolongation into mind, he wrote it would only be its reflection. So you can see Sri Aurobindo is again leaning on this power of intuition to reveal truly, but it's a lightning flash. It hits a point, or it's a thin prolongation. It is not the vast. The vast is Varuna, the oceanic, whose light must come to support, supplement, and become the base of the intuition as it flashes out. It's an ocean of light. The difference, not easy to define except by symbols, may be expressed if we take the Vedic image in which the sun represents the gnosis and the sky, midair, and earth, the mentality, vitality, physicality of man and of the universe. So if the sun Surya is above, the sky would be Swar, the midair Antariksha, and the earth Prithvi. Living on the earth, climbing into the midair, or even winging in the sky, the mental being, the Manomaya Purusha, would still live in the rays of the sun and not in its bodily light. So if the sun, the solar truth, the supramental, is raining down light upon us, even if we're illuminated by it, even if we're catching it in a receptive consciousness, we're still in the zone of the ignorance. We're still in this triple world. Yes, we're lit up, but it's not from our own being. This is not the light pouring out of one who exists by his own power, Swayambhu. This is light coming from above and invites us to further growth, does it not? And in those rays, he would see things not as they are, but as reflected in his organ of vision, deformed by its faults or limited in their truth by its restrictions. Interesting, because reflection is what Purusha does with Prakriti. Prakriti thinks it's conscious because Purusha's truth is reflected in it. Purusha thinks it's Prakriti because it's gazing at it. But here, in the divisive world of mind and downward, is where we lose the key to existence. To get it back, we have to rise into that consciousness where soul and nature are one, not separate. One is not the reflection of the other. And so he continues. But the Vijnanamaya Purusha lives in the sun itself, in the very body and blaze of the true light. Footnote, so the sun is called in the Veda, Ritam Jyotihi. Ritam, which is the ordered truth of being, Jyoti, which means light. So this is the light of the truth which orders itself. He knows this light to be his own self-luminous being, and he sees besides all that dwells in the rays of the sun, sees the whole truth of the lower triplicity, and each thing that is in it. He sees it not by reflection in a mental organ of vision, but with the sun of gnosis itself as his eye. For the sun, says the Veda, is the eye of the gods. The mental being, even in the intuitive mind, can perceive the truth only by a brilliant reflection or limited communication, and subject to the restrictions and in the inferior capacity of the mental vision. But the supramental being sees it by the gnosis itself, from the very center and outwelling fount of the truth, in its very form, and by its own spontaneous and self-illumining process. For the vijnana is a direct and divine, as opposed to an indirect and human knowledge. It rises from itself, it moves within itself, even when it seems to multiply itself as subjects and objects, all are within the same ambit of a single being. By identity, everything is fused, everything is one. The nature of the gnosis can only be indicated to the intellect by contrasting it with the nature of the intellect. And even then, the phrases we must use cannot illuminate unless aided by some amount of actual experience. So Sri Aurobindo again confirms that the greatest knowledge, the solid knowledge, what is really veridical, arises from deep, profound experience. But the words that form, that express this experience, he doesn't simply offer by illumination in this single essay. He is writing at the same time that this originally was composed, or soon would thereafter, the future poetry, in which he speaks about how this greater knowledge can fashion itself through the evolving capacity, even of the literary mind, into something that can capture powers, the luster of that truth. And of course, that leads to sophistry. For what language forged by the reason can express the suprarational? Suprarational, what is beyond the mind, above the mind? Fundamentally, this is the difference between these two powers, that the mental reason proceeds with labor from ignorance to truth, but the gnosis has in itself the direct contact, the immediate vision, the easy and constant possession of the truth, and has no need of seeking or any kind of procedure. The reason starts with appearances and labors, never or seldom losing at least a partial dependence on appearances to arrive at the truth behind them. It shows the truth in the light of the appearances, the formal aspect. The gnosis starts from the truth and shows the appearances in the light of the truth. It is itself the body of the truth and its spirit. The reason proceeds by inference. It concludes, but the gnosis proceeds by identity or vision. It is, sees, and knows. As directly as the physical vision sees and grasps the appearance of objects, so, and far more directly, the gnosis sees and grasps the truth of things. But where the physical sense gets into relation with objects by a veiled contact, the gnosis gets into identity with things by an unveiled oneness. Yokta, ekatvam, one yokes oneself to that, and then it is the same being. Thus, it is able to know all things as a man knows his own existence, simply, convincingly, directly. Here, it is not even an act of identity in its own plane, because all moves within a common being. To the reason, only what the senses give is direct knowledge, pratyaksha, which means, again, before the eyes. So it means direct sight. The rest of truth is arrived at indirectly. To the gnosis, all its truth is direct knowledge, pratyaksha. Therefore, the truth gained by the intellect is an acquisition over which there hangs always a certain shadow of doubt, an incompleteness, a surrounding penumbra of night and ignorance or half-knowledge, a possibility of alteration or annihilation by farther knowledge. The truth of the gnosis is free from doubt, self-evident, self-existent, svayambhu, irrefragable, absolute. The reason has as its first instrument observation general, analytical, and synthetic. It aids itself by comparison, contrast, and analogy, proceeds from experience to indirect knowledge by logical processes of deduction, induction, all kinds of inference, rests upon memory, reaches out beyond itself by imagination, secures itself by judgment. All is a process of groping and seeking. The gnosis does not seek, it possesses. Or if it has to enlighten, it does not even then seek. It reveals, it illumines in a consciousness transmuted from intelligence to gnosis. Imagination would be replaced by truth inspiration, Saraswati. Mental judgment would give place to a self-luminous discerning, viveka. The slow and stumbling logical process from reasoning to conclusion would be pushed out by a swift intuitive proceeding. The conclusion or fact would be seen at once in its own right by its own self-sufficient witness, and all the evidence by which we arrive at it would be seen too at once, along with it, in the same comprehensive figure, not as its evidence, but as its intimate conditions, connections and relations, its constituent parts, or its wings of circumstance. And of course, all of this is populated in his record of yoga, many notations about how intuition begins to play in the mind and the instinct and the hand, laboriously written down and in a very clear hand, where later he would scribble notes and letters to people. There he is writing with precision, taking his time, measuring it out. recording his experiences. Mental and sense observation would be changed into an inner vision using the instruments as channels, but not dependent on them, as the mind in us is blind and deaf without the physical senses, and this vision would see not merely the thing, but all its truth, its forces, powers, the eternities within it. Our uncertain memory would fall away, and there would come in its place a luminous possession of knowledge, the divine memory that is not a store of acquisition, but holds all things always contained in the consciousness, a memory at once of past, present, and future. Trikala Drishti, the vision that sees the three times, past, the present, and the future, as one beat of being, sempiternally, eternally, always contained in the consciousness, massed together, Chitgana, Chaitanya Kana. So I think this is where we'll put our bookmark. We'll finish the chapter next time. And I'll remember not to burn a stick of incense just before we begin, because it... such a profound emotional experience, it rather chokes me up. So we'll come to Savitri and read from early in the poem, in book one, the book of beginnings, canto three, the yoga of the soul's release. And we'll start on page 28. Towards the bottom. A consciousness of beauty and of bliss, a knowledge which became what it perceived, replaced the separated sense and heart, and drew all nature into its embrace. The mind leaned out to meet the hidden worlds. Air glowed and teemed with marvelous shapes and hues. In the nostrils quivered celestial fragrances. On the tongue lingered the honey of paradise. A channel of universal harmony. Hearing was a stream of magic audience, a bed for occult sounds earth cannot hear. Out of a covered tract of slumber self, the voice came of a truth submerged, unknown, that flows beneath the cosmic surfaces, only mid an omniscient silence heard, held by intuitive heart and secret sense. It caught the burden of secrecy sealed and dumb. It voiced the unfulfilled demand of earth and the song of promise of unrealized heavens and all that hides in an omnipotent sleep. In the unceasing drama carried by time, on its long listening flood that bears the world's insoluble doubt on a pilgrimage without goal, a laughter of sleepless pleasure foamed and spumed, and murmurings of desire that cannot die. A cry came of the world's delight to be, the grandeur and greatness of its will to live, recall of the soul's adventure into space, a traveler through the magic centuries, and being's labor in matter's universe, its search for the mystic meaning of its birth, and joy of high spiritual response, its throb of satisfaction and content in all the sweetness of the gifts of life, its large breath and pulse and thrill of hope and fear, its taste of pangs and tears and ecstasy, its rapture's poignant beat of sudden bliss, the sob of its passion and unending pain. The murmur and whisper of the unheard sounds, which crowd around our hearts but find no window to enter, swelled into a canticle of all that suffers to be still unknown, and all that labors vainly to be born, and all the sweetness none will ever taste, and all the beauty that will never be. Inaudible to our deaf mortal ears, the wide world rhythms wove their stupendous chant, to which life strives to fit our rhyme beats here, melting our limits in the illimitable, tuning the finite to infinity. A low muttering rose from the subconscient caves, the stammer of the primal ignorance, answer to that inarticulate questioning, there stooped with lightning neck and thunder's wings, a radiant hymn to the inexpressible and the anthem of the superconscient light. Read the rest. Namaste, Jai Ma.